Hello, Blocking Heads viewers. Welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm at the Center for American Progress. And with me today is Dr. James Joyner, the managing editor at the Atlantic Council and editor of Outside the Beltway blog. James, welcome.
Thanks, Matt.
How are you doing today?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
So the big news over, well, it broke Friday and has, you know, continued to escalate over the weekend is the resignation because of a extramarital affair of former General David Petraeus and and now former CIA Director David Petraeus. It's really interesting that Washington seems, I guess it's just the nature of journalism or sensationalism, that Washington continues to be intent on covering this story as a sex scandal,
right,
rather than a security scandal. I mean, granted, it has elements of sex in it, obviously, but it's interesting to me that, you know, even given what we know now, I mean, the issues involved here, people, you know, still want to cover the sexual affair angle of this.
Right. Well, I guess it shouldn't be that surprising, right? I mean, it's a more interesting topic, and, you know, frankly, most people don't know much about classified information. Yeah. And, you know, in Washington, leaking is so common, and, you know, you've had WikiLeaks and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think people don't understand. I mean, I've been watching, you know, Morning Joe the last couple of days, and, like, Joe Scarborough is just, like, apoplectic that the FBI like continued this investigation once, you know, it was found that there really was no criminal wrongdoing. Once you've got the CIA director involved, I mean, just the sex scandal, even, you know, if there's no issue directly involving, you know, release of classified information, that sort of thing is a huge blackmail risk. It's just, it's just not something you can do in that position.
Right.
And people seem to be oblivious to that.
Right, exactly. I mean, it seems like, drilling down and finding out, was there any breach of security? What is the risk? I mean, that's something you just don't want to deal with the director of the CIA.
Yeah, no kidding. It's, I mean, he's got the most sensitive classified information at his disposal. And,
right,
you know, again, it's a huge blackmail risk. I mean, I don't know at what point, his wife knew about it, if he found, she found out at the same time we did, if he had, you know, if he had confessed that to her weeks ago. I mean, I have no idea about any of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, it's something you can't have going on.
Now, I think, you know, the kind of communal hair pulling sackcloth and ashes that's going on over the, the resignation of Petraeus and, you know, the end to, I think it's probably safe to say the end to his official career, though. I mean, he'll probably. He'll go on to write articles and books and lecture and teach, et cetera. No question. But it's so interesting to see, you know, to really, really see again what a significant figure he has been as a soldier, as a military person. And I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, above and beyond his many accomplishments, this role that he played in his, you know, leadership of the surge in Iraq. I mean, he was the guy who made it okay for so many in Washington, who gave them permission to pretend that Iraq wasn't a huge screw-up.
Oh, no, that's right. You mean, it's funny, and you know, the titling is sort of, yeah, I guess a little sort of unfortunate in hindsight. I mean, I wrote a piece like almost 6 years ago, before he'd even, you know, officially taken over, I think, in Iraq, you know, warning against what I was calling Petraeus fetishism. You know, because and it was exactly that. It was, you know, the mere fact that David Petraeus said so meant that the discussion was over, right? It's like, Petraeus says this, you know, and, you know, by that point, President Bush he'd been reelected, but he was very much on the downside in terms of his personal reputation and his approval ratings. And he was very much sort of hiding behind Petraeus and saying, well, you know, you may not, like it coming from the commander in chief, but hey, the general says this.
Right.
And, you know, I sort of made two points at the time, which is, you know, one is as great as Petraeus is, and in terms of his accomplishments, and they are tremendous. You know, the fact of the matter is he had, you know, his record of success was pretty uneven, most notably in terms of Iraq, even before, you know, the surge.
Right, the security training.
His training did not go well at all. And he emerged unscathed from that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that is really it's great to bring up.
Yeah.
No, because he was brought in as kind of a guy who was like, okay, here's just a soldier who did his job. He's you know, the story was he's sort of untainted by the failures up till now, but that, of course, was not true.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And it's, you know, I mean, it may well have been that, you know, Petraeus did that mission, you know, better than anybody, you know, could have possibly done it. I mean, we have no, you know, no counterfactual to go by. But the fact is, he wasn't successful. And, you know, it's hard to say that, you know, that the Iraq War, that even the surge was successful, in other than that, you know, things were better than I guess they could have been, but they certainly didn't advance our strategic objectives in any notable way. I mean, it's not clear to me in any way that, you know, I mean, I think the regime change worked fine, and but I think that, you know, all of the goals post-regime change were largely unmet. You know, we sort of wound up sort of salvaging something worse than the worst of the Civil War that had gone on, you know, previously.
Right.
And to a large extent, the same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, it was again, you know, sent in Petraeus to save the day. He actually stepped down, you know, took what's, you know, essentially a demotion from CENTCOM back down to being the battlefield commander, you know, after, you know, Obama had fired two previous commanders in rapid succession. And I mean, it's not clear to me that that Petraeus had really saved Afghanistan. Again, I don't know that Afghanistan was savable. In fact, I'm, you know, I was arguing, you know, hell, during McKiernan's time, let alone McChrystal's time, that you know, that the surge was a bad idea because it was already well too late to get anything that was like the definition of victory we were claiming.
Right. No, but I think, you know, it's probably safe to say that we're, you know, we surged in Afghanistan because of the reputation of Petraeus and the story that he was a huge part of.
Oh, no question.
But I think there's two things here. One, in terms of the actual effects of the surge, I mean, and speaking as someone who was very, very skeptical that the surge would make any difference. You know, I admit now, and I admitted before, that I was incorrect at the extent to which, you know, an escalation, a U.S. troop escalation in the context of an ongoing military occupation could really, you know, make some positive changes. Now, the positive changes that it did make, I think the pretty strong consensus that it didn't create those changes. It kind of facilitated ongoing dynamics and things that are already moving in Iraq. So it was, it did play a part in the decline of violence. I think the signs was already starting. But still, I'll recognize that, and that's a positive thing. But as for this idea, and it's been amazing to watch this on Twitter and elsewhere as people react to the Petraeus story, is this idea that he turned the war around and we won the war. Or the kind of neoconservative version is that the war was won, and then President Obama came in and screwed everything up, and now Iran won the Iraq War, which is, you know, just preposterous on its face.
Sure.
But it is amazing to be reminded once again, as I was saying earlier, you know, the role that Petraeus played in helping people who desperately wanted to believe in American victory, that American victory was at hand.
Well, yeah, it's a larger problem, I think, in our society, and it's not one that's necessarily fixable, is because we have gone, and it's been, you know, more than a generation now, we went to an all-volunteer force in 1973. And as a consequence of that, and to some degree, even, you know, in the draft era force, you have the Vietnam War, where if you were going to college or you were well-connected, you could avoid service if you wanted to. And most people did want to, at least toward the end of that conflict. We've created a situation where, you know, most of our elites do not have military experience. And as a consequence of that, I think they are far, far too deferential to those of us who've been in the military, and especially to general officers. It's a cultural problem, but it's also a leadership problem, because, you know, going back to the Petraeus fetishism issue, is that, you know, while, you know, I am fully in support of giving the generals a free hand, or at least very wide latitude in terms of making tactical decisions and operational decisions, it is not the job of the generals to decide whether to go to war, when to end wars, what the mission should be.
That's a
political objective.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, you know, aside from civilian control issues, generals are very bad at making those decisions. The default position, I think, of the military, certainly the senior leadership in military, is to be overly reluctant, overly pessimistic about going to war.
Yeah.
And at, and then once committed and once, you know, sort of blood has been shed to be, you know, basically, you know, all in, one, you know, to sort of go back to the Petraeus thing again. And you say, oh, no, we can't leave now. We've gotten people killed, so we must see this thing through. And right. we need more. We just need more time, more resources, more troops. And, you know, again, there's the whether that's worth doing is a political decision. And sort of diverting that to the generals, I think it's just a bad idea. But it's what we've done because I think the you know, the civilian leadership is basically afraid of the military, and it both in sense of they revere the military, and there's this notion that you really can't say anything negative or you can't tell the military anything because you're, you know, not having been in harm's way, and therefore you don't have the right to speak. And it's just it's a bizarre notion, but it's one that's pretty fully spread in our society right now.
Right, and I mean, if you take that and then you also add to that, you know, the new Washington normal of doing battle through leaks, which we saw to an incredible degree during the, you know, the Afghanistan strategic review, and around when the decision was made whether to surge, you know, to surge or not to surge, and ongoing, and even, you know, as a part of this, you know, we saw it during, you know, the whole Benghazi thing, and now with this ongoing issue with the Petraeus affair with Paula Broadwell. Interestingly, this story that has come out now about an FBI investigator contacting Eric Cantor's office. Are you following this part of it?
I've seen some of it, yes.
Right. I mean, which is interesting. You know, someone gotten, I mean, apparently this guy was acting so irresponsibly that the FBI took him off the case or told him to stay away from the case. And he first contacted Dave Reichert of Washington, state representative, and then, and then passed along to Cantor, who knew a few weeks ago. Just, you know, obviously new bits of news coming out all the time. General Allen now possibly involved.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I don't really know what to say. It's just crazy.
It truly is, and it is a bizarre thing. I mean, it's part of the poisonous atmosphere, you know, of our system. I mean, is, you know, the chain of command is largely gone in that regard. It is, you know, I mean, this particular investigation. I mean, it looks like, you know, the shirtless FBI agent that you know, sort of is at the center of all this. You know, sort of, you know, had a personal relationship with the accuser, who's apparently also had a personal relationship with Allen and or Petraeus. So yeah, it's a very messy and. Yeah, the notion that you circumvent the you know, the normal process by, you know, sort of politicizing it, you know, is unfortunate, but is again not going away.
And then we're of course like presented with the surprising development that Eric Cantor behaved responsibly.
Yeah.
Which, you know, given, you know, this guy plays hardball, so I have to, you know, I have to give him a little bit of respect here for not trying to run with this, or it appears that he didn't try to run with this and behaved, you know, entirely appropriately. So,
you know, the interesting thing is that, I mean, you know, we saw that there was a, I remember John Stewart, you know, talking during the primaries that even like people like Michelle Bachmann and, you know, Rick Santorum, people who had, you know, been privy to that sort of information were actually more responsible than you know, some of the others, you know, on the you know, in the debates and whatnot.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I think just being aware of what the structures are and, you know, how the system works, it tends to make most of those people pretty pretty responsible, even though they're in, you know, case of, you know, Bachmann, for example, can be sort of, you know, just off the wall crazy in other ways. They actually tend to respond pretty well.
So that might be a good segue to the second part of our conversation. So, you know, we have President Obama reelected last Tuesday, a very, very good night for Democrats all around, keeping hold of the House, increasing their presence in, I'm sorry, keeping control of the Senate, increasing their presence in the House. You know, just looking at the foreign policy, I mean, feel free to, you know, opine on any of it, but I'm, you know, this looking at the foreign policy angle, you know, we saw, I think, conservative critics trying to make an issue of some very specific points. We had, you know, the whole Israel-Iran issue. We had Benghazi, obviously. I mean, I think it's safe to say that it was not, the election was not decided on foreign policy. It was clearly an economic oriented or an economy oriented election. But foreign policy did play a part. And I think in the wake of last Tuesday, there have been a number of interesting articles looking at the state of foreign policy in the Republican Party and the conservative movement. The neoconservatives still seem to me to be dominant, but there are other voices. You have Rand Paul, and you have the old school realists, people, you know, who are not reproducing as much. It's hard to, for me to identify any up and coming realist thinkers in the Congress. But what's your take on the landscape here?
Now, I mean, it's very interesting. I don't think foreign policy did play a huge role. I think the Iran thing, as much as it got flogged, I think that the last debate sort of demonstrated it to those of us who, or to those who weren't paying attention. I think those of us inside, or that do this for a living, I think sure already knew. But there was no light between Mitt Romney and Obama on Iran on a lot of the issues. I mean, basically, Romney's critique is, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, I would, do the same sanctions, and I would do basically what you're doing now, but I would have done it, with a little bit more backbone and speed.
Yeah.
I was like, well, okay, that's not really, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah.
And, and both, the Gallup poll, although Gallup has had some issues in terms of their reliability in terms of the election, they were a little bit off, but they were off in the other direction because the Gallup showed that President Obama had a pretty significant foreign policy advantage in terms of trust, over Romney in polls that were skewed Romney, in terms of election outcomes. And the exit polls that I've seen sort of showed the same thing, that to the people who said foreign policy was a big issue, which was a fairly small chunk of the electorate, but those who did tended to, again, to trust the president more so than Romney. And part of that, I think by and large, the president's done a good job of foreign policy. He's been prudent. But additionally, he sort of did sort of what Bill Clinton managed to do on domestic policy, which is to basically to take over the Republican position and take it for himself. And so the critiques of Obama's foreign policy that are interesting are largely critiques from the left. He basically, as I argued 6 months in a piece for the National Interest, that this was basically Bush's third term. And, because after getting just shellacked in the 2006 midterms, basically Bush shifted course.
Yeah.
The neocons became sort of receded or were thrown out of the administration largely. And, Condi Rice and Bob Gates and those people became ascendant. And you had a pretty standard realist Republican foreign policy for the last 2 years of administration. Go ahead.
No, I would agree with that to a point. I mean, yes, clearly Bush in 2006 changed course, listened to some of the saner people in his administration, Gates being foremost among them. And I would agree that Obama has, even after a lot of the promises he made as a candidate, has stayed with some of the general contours of a global war on terror, obviously the drone war being the most extreme example.
He's escalated the drone war. I mean, pretty
escalated the drone war significantly. Yeah. I do think first of all that the narrowing of the definition of who our enemies are was something that is very significant and means a lot strategically for our goals. And I do think, and I would say that there is a difference, even though, we're back to kind of negotiations and pressure and vague threats of military action with regard to Iran. I think the re-engagement in the multilateral process, the re-engagement at the UN, the re-engagement at the UN Human Rights Council, all of that piled on top of the efforts to talk to the Iranians, the outreach, the letters to the Supreme Leader, the Nowruz greetings, I think those... even though we are now at what could be said, okay, Bush did this, there was a lot of groundwork leading up to where we are now that strengthened our hand significantly that I think does represent a big difference from the way that the Bush administration went about trying to deal with Iran and the nuclear issue.
I think that's fair in terms of the multilateral engagement. I think Obama has been more successful – than Bush would have been in terms of getting, you know, especially getting EU backing for the Iran sanctions. Mm-hmm. Although I think that's more a matter of sort of style and process than strategy. But it's an important difference. I think that's fair.
And I think, you know, there is a sense, I mean, I think when, you know, I talk about re-engagement at the UN, the UN Human Rights Council being, I mean, listen, you can have your criticisms of the UN Human Rights Council. I certainly do.
Sure.
Or the UN in general. Mm-hmm. But I think this is, I mean, a consistent theme of the first Obama administration was a re-engagement in multilateral processes and organizations. And I think this is where we can locate, you know, a difference among liberal progressives on foreign policy and conservatives. And correct me if you disagree with this. I think the latter, liberals and progressives, as the Obama administration has shown, I mean, they believe, and I think it's true, that engagement in these international organizations lends a sort of legitimacy that functions as a force multiplier as we try to achieve our various goals.
I think that's right. Because I've argued for quite a while now that there's the differences between liberal interventionists and, you know, neoconservatives are actually pretty small in terms of grand thing, because they tend to be in favor of really muscular interventionist mm-hmm. foreign policy, you know, including the use of military force, you know, to do good in the world. The main difference is that Republicans are less concerned and neocons generally are less concerned about, you know, the imprimatur of the UN, you know, than are, you know, the liberal interventionists. And mm-hmm. that sort of works both ways. I mean, for mm-hmm. example, I mean, in Syria, I'm neither a neocon nor a liberal interventionist. I tend to be a realist on these things. Mm-hmm. And my default position on interventions is don't do it and do it, you know, in Syria, for example, I mean, the UN is either, you know, either you believe the Obama administration and they really want to do something in Syria and they're being hamstrung by, you know, the fact that the Russians and the Chinese have a veto, or what I actually think is the case is they don't want to do anything in Syria and it's a damn convenient excuse to not do anything in Syria. Well, you know, the UN won't let us.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes. Right. So, but it, you know, it's a difference. And you know, and the neocons would say, hey, look, you know, if our policy is that Assad must go and that, you know, we can't tolerate, you know, tens of thousands of people being murdered, then, you know, screw the UN. Let's get a coalition of the willing, you know, and go do the job. And I think you can make the argument for either one. I think if intervention is the right course, then I tend to side I do take the Republican side. I really don't care what the UN says if we're actually in the national security interest of the United States to intervene in Syria. I don't think the opinions of, the authoritarian regimes in Moscow and, you know, Beijing should be, you know, foremost in our minds.
Well, I think that's true, but I mean, I think there's also a question, okay, what things can we do to mitigate that resistance?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So, I mean, I think, say, take Turkey, for example. Mm-hmm. Conservatives argue and did argue, well, so what? Turkey opposes our invasion of Iraq, whatever. We're America. We do what we want. They're being an unfaithful partner. And, you know, not having Turkey's cooperation really kind of screwed us.
Oh, it very much did, yes.
So,
I mean, I don't know that it mattered in the long run. I mean, I think that it made the part of the operation that went easy harder, still pretty easy, even without. I mean, the problem was what to do after regime change. And I assume Rumsfeld thought the answer was go home and hope for the best and, you know, got overruled given the way we planned it. But no, you're right. I mean, we would have been better off, with Turkey on our side, with France on our side, or perhaps, listening to Turkey and France and say, okay, maybe this isn't such a good idea, but.
Right. I mean, so I think the point I'm making is not like we don't let these countries' agreement or disagreement determine how we define our interests. It's just, these things do have an impact on whether we can achieve certain goals, you know, in the further into those interests.
Sure.
So I think, you know, liberals and conservatives might do somewhat of a different calculation there on weighing the importance of these things. But getting back to the current state of foreign policy in the conservative movement, in the Republican Party, what's your take on it? How do you see things right now?
Well, and sort of going back to where we sort of diverge is that, I mean, I think what's happened is that President Obama basically has undercut the Republican message. I mean, he, you know, has been for decades, certainly as long as I've been even, you know, following this, even like going back to, you know, when I was in like junior high school. You know, the Republicans have had the advantage of foreign policy literally my entire lifetime. The last presidential election where the, you know, Democrat had the advantage in foreign policy was 1964. You know, since then, you know, the Republicans have always had, well, you know, we're stronger. We've got the national security credentials that the Democrats don't have. The Democrats were perceived as weak and pacifist or whatever, initially from the outgrowth of the Vietnam War, but then, you know, the Carter years and nuclear freeze and all that sort of stuff. Well, that went away for a while. It was irrelevant in the 90s, right? After the Cold War, you know, Bill Clinton didn't matter that he didn't have a lot of foreign policy credentials, that he was perceived as weak in foreign policy. Who cared? Because there was no enemy. It became a big issue again post 9/11. You know, the Republicans a couple of elections, even though Iraq was unpopular, Bush was still perceived as strong against terrorism, etc. Well, that is gone now. Partly, I think, because Iraq, the way Iraq played out, I think the Republicans lost a lot of credibility. But secondarily, I think that that Obama has basically taken the Republican position and run with it in terms of, you know, again, you're right in terms of process and the UN, et cetera. But it's hard to out-strong Obama, right? He got bin Laden. He's, you know, we're having drone wars and chasing terrorists and, you know, more countries than I can list off the top of my head. And it's pretty aggressive. He surged in Afghanistan, which I think we both agreed was the wrong policy. But it was certainly the strong policy. You know, it's what the military wanted. And I sort of have contended going back to 2009 that politics, domestic politics, drove the surge decision, that I think it was a calculated, you know, especially as a Democrat, right? You know, if only Nixon could go to China, you know, Obama can't leave Afghanistan prematurely when the generals are saying more, more, more. He would have been hammered by the Republicans, by the military, may well have lost the election. I think but having gone the way he did, Romney and the Republicans were still playing the old playbook. Oh, well, gee, you know, weak on foreign policy, weak on Iran, weak on Israel. And it looks stupid. It was a stupid argument given, you know, what was going on. It's like, well, gee, you know, he got bin Laden. He's, you know, we're having a muscular intervention here, there, and everywhere. Libya, and Syria again. I think the Americans didn't want to go into Syria, and Romney really didn't articulate an alternative vision. And ditto Iran, to the extent that people care about Iran, and I'm not sure they do all that much. He really didn't articulate anything that's substantially different than what's already being done. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's an interesting position. In terms of where to go, I mean, I think it's going to take a while. I'm working on a piece for The Atlantic, essentially arguing that, the Republicans ought to pick back up the foreign policy that George W. Bush ran on in 2000, you know.
The humbler foreign policy.
Humbler, less intervention, less nation building. Let's take care of our business at home. Let's, keep obviously strong defense, keep, our alliances strong, et cetera. But, less, long-term commitment of force, less sort of, willy-nilly, use of force and the extension and the blood and treasure that caused. And whether he intended to run that foreign policy or not is unclear because he didn't get much to do it. And 9/11, I disagree with those who said 9/11 changed everything, but it did change that. It became sort of an untenable policy. Although, again, we could have not invaded Iraq, but, invading Afghanistan was, overwhelmingly sort of supported and mandated given 9/11. So
who do you see? I mean, when we look at Congress, when we look at the next generation of conservative leaders, it's very easy to find the muscular, the Marco Rubios, who kind of have we could call a neoconservative outlook, much muscular American leadership, lots of military intervention. You can find, you know, you've got Rand Paul, and I'm trying to think of others like that who, you know, who are more I mean, you can call them isolationist, and even others who are just, who are kind of practically isolationist coming from a fiscal standpoint. But what are the other strains right now? Are there any other real strains? I mean, going back to the question of realists, are the realists producing themselves in the Republican Party?
No, that's, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, certainly in Congress, I don't know who they are. I mean, except for Rand Paul, and I can't imagine that he's a viable presidential contender for a variety of reasons. You know, so you may have to go to the states where those guys basically don't have foreign policies. I mean, there is that strain out there, right? There's the, you know, the Daniel Larisons and others at the American Conservative, for example, who, you know, had that position. I mean, Pat Buchanan, I think his days of running for president are over, at least I hope they are. But there is that strain out there, but I don't know who, you know, their representatives are in the political class. In the intellectual class, there are plenty of us, but the, certainly it's just, again, I think one, you know, Republicans, I've argued on domestic policy and foreign policy have been running, you know, from the Reagan playbook a little too long now, and just not having understood that the ground has changed. And I argue largely that Republicans won on so many issues. I mean, not on the social issues. I think the social issues, they're losing and pretty much always have been losing. It's just a matter of time. But, you know, in terms of, you know, we're at a point now where on tax policy, you know, we're talking about, you know, returning to, you know, Reagan era, you know, cuts as being, you know, whether it's communism or socialism, right? And I think we're sort of there on defense. I think, you know, the Democrats, you know, at least at the national level, they're for huge defense. They're for, you know, interventionism. They're for, you know, pretty muscular foreign policy. And, you know, running on weak is just not a sound strategy anymore. So you have to have an alternative, I think. Or, you know, you basically, you know, the politics stops at the water's edge and foreign policy just no longer becomes, you know, a campaign thing. But I don't know if that happens. But yeah, I don't know who the representatives are. I'm not sure who the you know, viable people are. I don't even know, like, for example, Paul Ryan. I don't even know what his foreign policy is, really, because it's not what he's talked about. And, you know, he was obviously just whatever, you know, Romney talked about on foreign policy, which wasn't much, was his echo. So
I mean, yeah, I mean, what you're getting, it's a good point that there are, you know, realism is fairly well represented among people who write and comment on foreign policy. But there is no kind of realist champion right now among actual elected representatives.
I think that's right.
Is it partly because, I mean, I'm just kind of throwing this out there, is it partly because realism tends to lend itself very poorly to kind of demagoguery or political grandstanding?
There is that, and plus, I think it takes a while for the political class, who for the most part, frankly, don't know foreign policy. They, you know, they're handed sort of cue cards and memorize them. And I think people, you know, I think we're still in sort of, you know, 9/11 mentality and war and terrorism, rah rah, and the way the politics, the domestic politics of that went, you know, I mean, I've seen it on the blogs for years, right? That you know, people that were sort of on my side of things, you know, in blog arguments, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005, simply because of the Iraq War, you know, once that sort of went away as an issue, it changed on the intellectual side. But I don't think it has changed. I don't think that has filtered over yet into the elected political class, who are still sort of fighting, you know, that last war, still championing, you know, the war on terror and all that, which, again, at some point it's got to sort of end, or at least strategically it has to, you know, the way you fight it has to sort of change.
So is it that the way we continue to talk about foreign policy just makes it difficult for someone to
mount
a kind of sustained, you know, a sustained articulation of a realist agenda?
Well, I think so. I mean, realism is sort of boring, right? In terms of, you know, as a stump speech, right?
Right. I mean, that's what I was getting at with my point about demagoguery. I mean, that's not the right word. Like inspirational, you know, kind of, you know, real big theme politics and realism.
Well, that's right.
To lend itself to that.
And the other problem is, you know, which is, you know, one that's been talked about quite a bit this last week is, you know, the Republican communications sort of establishment, you know, the Fox mm-hmm. News, Rush Limbaugh, right. Sean right. Hannity nexus, yeah. you know, Drudge Report, et cetera. You know, if you're sort of outside of that sort of set of talking points, yeah. you're an outsider, you're right. a rhino, you're whatever.
Right. That's a great point.
And it's hard to, fight that tide. Yeah. And, you know, the question is, you know, it does look like even like the Bill Kristols of the world are seeming to like wake up on like some of the domestic stuff. I don't know whether mm-hmm. they will on the foreign policy side. But it's going to have to, I think the intellectual class will have to, you know, sort of make realism safe again, I think. And I do think it's the default position of the Republican Party. The Republican Party has been, you know, for generations, had been an anti-interventionist party yeah. largely. Right. And, you know, 9/11 and, you know, the sort of changed that in a muscular way. Although even in the 90s, while the liberal interventionists, you know, under Clinton were ascendant, there was a pretty large, you know, even people like Bob Dole were very much, yeah, we need to do good in the world, which is, I don't think those guys were neocons, but mm-hmm. the neocons were glommed on to that position and at least for a while were the dominant force, and maybe they still are, because I mean the other problem of course is that just the nature of the way we do things in this town is that, you know, you tend to get people in senior positions of of administrations who were in a step or two down in the previous yeah. administration of that party, right. and so that means you've got to either get Condi Rice, Colin Powell, sort of acolytes the next time Republicans have power, or, you know, there's a much larger class of the neocons who were, you know, the Rumsfeld Cheney acolytes. And that's just, and so, for example, you know, it was hard to read the tea leaves with Mitt Romney, since he wouldn't tell us what his foreign policy was.
Yeah.
We're trying to read the tea leaves from his advisors, and his mm-hmm. advisors were sort of all over the map. You could pick and choose what you wanted. Well, you know, he's got some like people who aren't crazy on his team. Some who are, but you know, there are plenty of not crazy people that you can point to that maybe he's going to listen to those. So it's it'll be interesting. And of course,
yeah, you know, I mean, I'll admit I'm relieved that we're not going to find out.
yeah, sure.
But anyway, James, I'll bring this to a close. Thanks so much for talking to me today, and we'll do it again soon.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.